thank you very much. Gloria has brought us up to date, and what I want to do as one of the lawyers of the five is to explain how we got here, how, after all, this is a case, the case of the five, and it is still an ongoing case. And how did this case materialize, and what is its origination, and why is it so critically important that it has mobilized more than 200 organizations around the world in their support? It was also the longest case in trial in the United States at the time it occurred, almost 7 months in duration. It is the only case in which a charge of espionage was launched, conspiracy to commit espionage, where one admiral, two generals, and the advisor to the President of the United States on Cuban matters all testified, but testified for the defense. That had never happened before. So how did it begin? It began essentially with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the socialist states of Eastern Europe, where the Cuban economy was very much affected and went into a tailspin and had to be resuscitated by any means. And the Cubans chose tourism as an industry, which would bring in immediately hard currency as a way of lifting Cuba out of the economic decline. And so hotel chains in Canada, in Italy, in Spain, entered into agreements with Cuba. Hotels were built. A new airport terminal was built. Tour buses were brought in. And the Cubans relied upon their natural resources, sun and beaches, the beauty of its countryside, its people, to help bring it out of the economic decline. But the people who were in the exile community in Miami, who had been fomenting violence against Cuba sporadically over the previous 30 years, saw this as an opportunity to finally bring the Cuban government to its knees. Because the tourism industry is a vulnerable industry. If you can frighten people from coming to a tourist destination, the tourism industry collapses. And so that crowd in Miami, now emboldened with the fall of the socialist states, embarked upon a public campaign to dissuade people from coming to Cuba. No one wants to go to a tourist destination with their families when there is danger, when there are bombings, when there is arson, when there are killings. And so that campaign, publicly announced in Miami, where a conference was held, a press conference was held, and these people announced that henceforth Cuba will be an open zone, a zone where anything that moves will be considered a target. And the hotels were bombed, and a bomb was placed in the terminal, and bombs were found on tourist buses. And as you will hear, an Italian tourist was killed while seated in the lobby of a hotel. Small boats were brought offshore from Havana with cannon aboard, and they fired artillery shells into the hotels that lined the shoreline. Cuba protested each of these actions to the State Department of the United States. They even brought an action in the Security Council of the United Nations, claiming what? That the United States was harboring terrorists. Years before 9/11, that item is still on the agenda of the Security Council, has never been acted upon. But all of these protests were cast aside, and Cuba exhausted all means of bringing to the world's attention the fact that it was being victimized by essentially cross-border, cross-states attacks on its country. The attackers never targeted the Cuban Navy and Air Force or the Cuban Army. These are all civilian targets, the classic definition of terrorism. When all else failed, the five volunteered to come to the United States to infiltrate these groups in southern Florida and to find out their plans and to report those plans to Cuba so that Cuba could defend itself. They came without guns. They had no explosives. They had no armament. They caused, in more than 5 years in the United States, no sabotage, no arson, no American citizens were injured. But they did succeed, and they infiltrated these groups, and they reported back to Cuba, and Cuba was able to take steps to protect itself. Finally, in 1998, the Cubans invited a group from the FBI to Havana, where they provided this delegation, which came with volumes showing photographs, names, addresses, the camps where these people trained, and they trained in camps with camouflage uniforms and automatic weapons. That was shown on Miami television. And all of this was given to the FBI, and the FBI assured the Cubans that they would study these volumes and they would take the necessary steps to stop this cross-border terrorism. Cuba is still waiting for a response. But what happened in September of 1998, the FBI rounded up the five and put them into isolation cells immediately, even though they weren't armed and there was no charge of violence against anyone in Miami, where they remained for 17 months before they were brought to trial. And when they were brought to trial, there were 26 charges against them. Most of them were relatively minor charges, things like using a false name, which they did, failing to register with the Attorney General of the United States, which they were obliged to do as foreign agents. That constituted most of the case, but there was a charge of conspiracy to commit espionage, which carried a life sentence, and that was the centerpiece of the government's case. But the government had a problem. There never was in the history of the United States a charge of conspiracy to commit espionage without secrets, without a secret government document. And the government had obtained, in the course of its investigation, 20,000 pages of correspondence between the five and Cuba. But not one page was a classified document. And so they had a difficulty, and they knew it. So in order to buttress their case, 7 months later, they filed another charge, this one conspiracy again, which is a favored charge in a political case, because you don't have to prove the crime occurred. You only have to prove, when there's a conspiracy charge, that there was an agreement to commit the crime at some point in the future. And the government did say to the jury in this case, we have no proof of espionage, but this case does not require it. All you have to find is that there was an agreement to commit it at some point. The government 7 months later added a new charge. This was conspiracy to commit murder, and this also was unprecedented in the history of the United States, and I believe probably in the history of the world. And that was a charge against one of the five that he, Gerardo Hernandez, had conspired with pilots in the Cuban Air Force 2 years earlier to shoot down two aircraft in which four people were killed as the planes were entering Cuban airspace and were warned against going further. There had never been a case like that. And so the case went to trial with 27 counts. But the case went to trial in Miami, home to 650,000 exiles. The mayor is Cuban-American. The head of the FBI is Cuban-American. The head of the U.S. Attorney's Office is Cuban-American. The county commissioners are Cuban-American. The owner of the Miami Herald is Cuban-American. The attorney in the largest law firm, the senior partner, is Cuban-American. There's nothing wrong with this. This is the history of immigrant communities in the United States. Immigrant communities bond together and elect their own, as they should. But none of them would have held office if they hadn't had a strong anti-Castro, anti-Cuban revolution position. It was part of the culture of Miami, and it had been the overriding culture of Miami for 40 years. And that was known, and that was the one city in the United States where they couldn't get a fair trial. And so they asked to move the case. Did they ask to move the case to New York or Washington, where they could have gotten a fair trial? No, they asked to move the case 25 miles to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, where they could have gotten a fair trial, just outside of Miami. The Oklahoma City bomber, when he faced charges in Oklahoma, had his case moved 1,200 miles to Denver in an effort to get a fair trial. This was a request to move the case 25 miles, 40 minutes up the freeway. And it was denied, rejected. And so they went to trial in Miami, and of course, the result was foregone, despite the fact that the evidence in their favor was overwhelming. So much so that at the end of the trial, the government took an emergency appeal to an appellate court saying that on the question of conspiracy to commit murder, our case is deficient and we face, the word they used, an insurmountable obstacle to gaining a conviction here. And the appellate court rejected that appeal and the jury brought back a conviction even though the prosecutor said we can't get a conviction. What was there about that conspiracy to commit murder charge? For 25 months before those planes were shot down in 1996, there were 20 overflights of Cuba by a group called Brothers to the Rescue, which had started out as a charitable organization rescuing rafters who were attempting to come to the United States from Cuba and who were in peril on the high seas. But after that situation was remedied by an agreement that was reached between Cuba and the United States in 1994, there no longer was a mission of that nature, and so they began to team up with the other groups operating out of Miami to begin to launch offensive actions against the Cuban government. And they overflew the country repeatedly, dropping propaganda leaflets. And what one of the five found out, they were beginning a different kind of practice. They were beginning to practice in Florida dropping pipe bombs. And when these civilian aircraft were used, people said to me, well, these were civilian aircraft. They were called civilian aircraft. They were Navy surplus planes that were used by the Contras in the Contra War against Nicaragua. They were capable of dropping bombs and armament and harming people. And Cuba, now aware of what the second stage was going to be, called down Admiral Carroll, retired admiral of the United States Navy. And the head of the Cuban Air Force met with him and said to Admiral Carroll, we are now going to do what every country does in the world. We're going to defend our airspace and our sovereignty. And you should go back to the United States, convene meetings in the Pentagon and the State Department, and tell them that we're going to do this. Admiral Carroll was a witness. He told the jury about this meeting he had in Havana where he was given that warning and he was told to stop these overflights, each one of which was a violation of international law and U.S. law as well. But he was told that the political realities were such that the United States was not going to take any steps to stop these overflights because they were part of the political core of southern Florida, and so they couldn't be stopped. And indeed, one day in February 96, they took off from a base in Florida, Opa-locka Airport. They filed a false flight plan. They headed going west, and then at a certain point, with a beeline, headed straight for Havana. And Havana was warned that they were coming. Were they warned by Gerardo Hernandez? No. They were warned by the FAA in Miami, who called the FAA in Havana and said, these planes are veering off their flight path, and they're coming straight for you. And then what happened? The FAA in Miami got on the phone and spoke directly to the lead aircraft. That tape was introduced into evidence in the trial. And the FAA in Havana's Cuban FAA said to the lead pilot, you are heading toward a military protected zone. Turn back. And the plane kept coming. And Cuba scrambled two MiG-25s, which met the planes just as they were about to enter Cuban airspace or were already in Cuban airspace. There was a difference and an argument amongst radars as to right where the planes were, but we're talking about seconds, either inside Cuban airspace or not, but the planes were shot down, and four people perished. But Gerardo Hernandez had nothing to do with this. And so the case against him is deficient, and I'm sure, as Gloria says, we're waiting for this decision. I don't know what the decision will be, but I can tell you the judges who heard the case were in a state of disbelief that there could be a conviction based on this kind of evidence. And I'm very confident that that charge will go away. And Gerardo Hernandez got a life sentence on that charge. So he's doing two life sentences. And the three who were involved in infiltrating the groups and reporting back, they got life sentences as well, without a single sheet of classified documents. The same life sentence that Aldrich Ames and Robert Walker and Robert Hansen, the leading spies in the history of the United States, who gave hundreds and thousands of documents to the Soviets for millions of dollars, compromising the lives of double agents. My client, Antonio Guerrero, is doing the same life as Aldrich Ames and Robert Hansen. It's absolutely and utterly inconceivable that this could go forward. And yet, we are still in the process of fighting the case. And so, as Gloria said, we are at a critical juncture. We won an appeal. It was unprecedented. Never before in the history of the United States had a sitting federal judge been reversed for failing to change venue? Had never happened before. And the three judges who heard that argument, which we made, had 80 years of judicial experience amongst the three of them. And they issued a unanimous 93-page opinion, the longest opinion ever written on venue, saying that Miami was a perfect storm of prejudice and bias against these five. They never should have been tried there. A perfect storm of prejudice. And as Gloria said, Alberto Gonzalez directed the U.S. attorneys in Miami to appeal that to the entire 12 judges. And we kind of laughed. We said, they will never take this case because these three eminent judges wrote a long opinion, unanimous, that was unprecedented. They'll never take this case for review. They took it. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta took their case. I found out later that that circuit court had not ruled in favor of the accused in a quarter of a century. And they took the case, and the perfect storm of prejudice became, in their hands, a beautiful sunny day of tolerance and fairness. And so all the convictions were reinstated, which is where they are now. And we had to go back again for a third time to argue before another panel in that court so that the substantive parts of the case, not the venue parts, can be reviewed, which they were in an argument. As was mentioned on August 20th, just this past August 20th, and we're now waiting for an opinion. We have a three-judge court again. Two of the judges sat on our original case. The third judge retired. He was an eminent jurist, Judge Oakes, but he was up in his 80s, and he retired. And so the circuit picked another judge to replace him. And they picked Judge Pryor to replace him, who is our third judge. Judge Pryor was a George Bush nominee who, when his nomination came to the Senate, there was a filibuster by Senator Kennedy. And the Atlanta Constitution, which is where the 11th Circuit is based in Atlanta, wrote an editorial about Judge Pryor's nomination. And what was the headline of the editorial? Right-wing zealot not fit to judge. He's our third judge. Maybe one of the most discredited federal judges in the United States. So he was selected to sit on this panel with two of the judges who ruled in our favor the last time we were on appeal. So we are mindful of the problem that this presents, but we are also confident that our two judges are holding firm, the two judges who said this was a perfect storm of prejudice now are looking at other aspects of the case, and I hope favorably. Well, as Gloria said, this is a critical juncture and a critical time, and we really welcome the support that we get, the support that we get in Canada, as well as the support, and I see many faces here from the U.S. who I've met in various speaking venues before, and I apologize to you all. You've heard this before. I try to make it a little different if I can each time, but I'm constrained by a record of 119 volumes of testimony, over 20,000 pages of exhibits. It's enormous. It's a huge case. I'm glad I'm given 30 minutes to discuss the case. When we first argued the case in the 11th Circuit, my client, Antonio, doing a life sentence, 119 volumes, 20,000 pages of exhibits, I was given an opportunity to present his case. I was given 3 minutes. That is what's called new appellate practice in the United States. Any one of you who have faced a traffic ticket, I assume, have gotten a little more time than that to present your position. But with a life sentence in the balance, that is the current means of practice in the United States. Today, I don't want to get off on that. That could be another half hour. But I want to thank you for coming tonight and being part of this conference, and those of you in the public who've come for tonight's event, I want to thank you for coming, and I hope with this we learn more, we get more of the facts, we get an understanding of what this case really is about, because like the Pentagon Papers trial, which I was involved in, this is not just a case of an injustice in the United States. Of course, it is that. But it is also a review, like the Pentagon Papers was with respect to Vietnam, of a 40-year policy that was an injustice in terms of international law, international morality, And so the case is linked to a policy, a foreign policy failure, and a policy domestically, which also is an injustice in terms of our court processes. So thanks for being with us, and hopefully with this go-around, we'll begin the process of bringing them home.